I think so. Yes, I think so. I don't know. The doctor looked again, sat back on his little stool and said, well, the interesting thing is you have optical neuritis, an inflammation of the nerves in the eye. He turned on the light and said, it's usually a symptom of MS, multiple sclerosis. He looked at me. But I have to say, it simply didn't register. I think it's all the medication I'm taking, I said. I don't have MS, I told him. I was eager to get back to Fox Center and cigarettes. So I imagine we made an appointment to return for a follow-up visit. During that time, the pain subsided, or I figured it was my teeth, or a side effect of the antabuse, as my copy of the PDR informed me. 3 weeks later, I was back in Dr. Lerner's chair. He examined both eyes, sat back, and confirmed, I must have been wrong. The optical neuritis is gone. On my release from Fox Center, I flew back to New York, newly sober, to pursue my acting career. I booked a real job, a movie with Adrienne Grenier called Arresting Gina, where I was to play a struggling drug addict. The role was in my wheelhouse, and I was excited for it. Before I told anyone else the news, I called my father. I was proud to report the news after he had kindly covered my Parkside Evangeline bills. We spoke regularly in those days. He had a new girlfriend, a struggling TV anchor who was trying to break into show business. Katie told me. Elliot never mentioned her to me. That's when the letters started coming. 20 letters a day arrived via FedEx at the production office of Arresting Gina. All of them written by a mysterious sender. They contained bogus information about me and my violence and addiction. They obliquely referenced my attack on the nurse at Fox Center. The letters mentioned heroin, which I'd never tried, and warned the director to fire me, claiming I was a liability. The return address was always from a place in Chicago called Faces and Places, a fake agency. I was fired before we even started shooting. The letters continued for a year and a half, during which I was fired from every job I booked. I was quietly hysterical when finally I was contacted by a detective who is retained by the talent agency UTA. He said he had been hired to protect Drew Barrymore, the famous and adorable actress to whom I was supposedly writing death threats. After weeks spent trailing me, he realized I wasn't the perpetrator and got in touch to let me know. He also had information. He said the letters were being mailed from my father's office building in Detroit. He gave me a description of the sender that just happened to match my father's girlfriend at the time, I found out. The detective, Kevin, told me to lay a trap to find the culprit. I had secured a screen test at Universal for a movie called Father's Day, which seemed like as good a time as any to see if my father's girlfriend was the saboteur. At the detective's urging, I told three different stories to three different people. I told my ex-boyfriend that I had a screen test against Alyssa Milano. I told a friend I had a screen test against Alicia Silverstone. I told my father I had a screen test against Drew Barrymore. Sadly, the name Drew Barrymore became involved in the story again. The head of casting at Universal received no fewer than 15 letters saying I was a violent and dangerous person who held a grudge against Drew Barrymore. The casting director showed me and my agent, Jana, the letters. Humiliated, I told my father he was now dead to me. I didn't speak to him for 12 years, and our relationship, already challenging, never fully recovered. Years later, I begged my agent at UTA to get me an audition with Drew Barrymore for the new Charlie's Angels. Nancy Juvonen, Drew's production partner, queried, don't you know the history with Selma and Drew? End of discussion. I was mortified. I had no idea the story had followed me for so long. I opened a bottle of white wine, drank it, and cried. I never tried to audition for Drew again. When I finally met Drew in person at Tracy Ross, the LA clothing store on Sunset, popular in the early aughts, much later, I discovered she'd never truly known the whole story. Only that it was a father thing, a messed up situation. I told her I was so, so sorry about the letters she'd received. She hugged me and said, "Don't worry, we all have wild family stuff." And her big embrace smoothed out some of those years-old anxieties. It's still a fright to me, the sabotage, the fear. But I count my lucky stars. The famous star is the dearest Drew, who seems to have an unending source of compassion. LA. After at least 60 more auditions in New York, Jana told me it was time for Los Angeles. "You need to go west, young woman." It was pilot season. It was also time for a new era to begin. I was happy to leave the roaches behind, along with the cold, numbing winters, and so westward I went. Jana set me up with two agents, Bonnie Lightke and fresh-faced Julie Taylor. Perfectly suited, I was happy at the Oakwood Corporate Housing in Burbank on Coyote Drive, which was close to the agencies and Warner Brothers. I had a Murphy bed that came down from the wall and a cat named I Know, whom I adopted from a shelter back in New York. The name came out of our first night together when he cried and cried and cried, and I said, I know, you're hungry, you're sad, I know. It stuck. I was immediately taken with Los Angeles. The smell of jasmine at night, the vast highways, the lights, the novelty of eating a bagel while sitting under a palm tree. It was unbelievable to me. A vacation, almost. As part of my fresh start in LA, I went really blonde. Art Luna was the guy. He had a chic hair studio in West Hollywood. I saw Sherry, a blonde colorist to the stars. The first time there, Angelica Houston was getting her hair done beside the wash sink where I sat. The movie Pritzi's Honor was a favorite of my mother's and mine, and now here she was, right in front of me. Angelica complimented my straw wedge shoes. "I had a pair of those back in the day," she told me. Her presence was the perfect balance of commanding and fun. She asked where I got them. And I told her the truth, Steve Madden. The admission hurt. I wished I could say Cacharel, or anything, for that matter. But Steve Madden was within my budget, and Angelica was kind. "How marvelous," she said, and told me she planned to get a pair of her own. When it came to my career, Jana was my point person, along with Bonnie and Julie. All three of them were quick-witted and hilarious, pretty and stylish. Bonnie is still a big deal in the film business. Julie went on to create Soul Cycle and sell it. The very first job I booked there was a movie with Suzanne Summers and Chad Crist. As soon as I was cast, my brand new sunny blonde hair was dyed dark brown. Suzanne was the blonde, of course, so I had to go dark. It was darker than I'd ever gone before, and that was how it remained. I already knew Chad from my time in New York, and I found him to be beautiful and cool. And Suzanne! I watched Three's Company when I was a kid ad nauseum, and I couldn't believe my great fortune to work with my favorite adult childhood sitcom star. She was glorious. Bubbling with excitement, a grand, toothy smile, almost a caricature of herself. That's how strong her real presence is. I liked her immediately. I remember the imprint of her long, tan toes in her rose-pink suede BB wedges. Alan, so in love, was ever by her side. One night we went to dinner, and I can still picture her long fingers plucking a warm pita slice from the bread basket. "Oh, I love this bread," she trilled. "If a place has bad bread, forget it." I was shocked that the food-combining master ate bread, and I told her so. I love it. Of course you can. Just with the right things, she replied. I continued on audition after audition, learning lines in my green Levi's bought by an ex in New York. There were little sprinkles of fairy dust that kept me going. I got close on so many pilots. But I wasn't pretty enough, I wasn't shiny enough, I wasn't energetic enough. I wasn't killing them. I was too tough here. Unable to afford the Oakwood any longer, I moved out and found a small apartment in a brick apartment building on Gretna Green in Brentwood, around the corner from where Nicole Brown was murdered in her front courtyard. I had a studio over the garage and dumpster, but I was hopeful. I was happy. I liked the warmth, the joggers, finding my way. I knew I was going to need big-time luck. But I also had these three women looking out for me, Jana, Julie, Bonnie. I had an inkling that somehow it would all work out. My mother casually asked when I was going to come home. Just come home, Blair. You can work at CVS. She acted as if my interest in acting were very foolish and impractical. She said she didn't understand the appeal at all. If I wasn't a success, why was it worth it? But I wasn't ready to give up and move home as much as my mother wanted me back in Michigan. Kevin Williamson wanted me to test for the role of Joey on Dawson's Creek. I auditioned and thought that I really nailed the part. I wore a beaded choker, my hair tucked back with a bobby pin, parted on the side. I tested against Katie Holmes. She was so tall, so pretty. She wore headphones and Birkenstocks. She kept to herself. Of course, I didn't get that part, and the rest is history. But I kept getting close. Alec Baldwin saw a short film I was in at the Hamptons International Film Festival and wrote a little piece about me in a festival paper, calling my performance a display of flat-out star power, like a combination of Marlene Dietrich meets Deborah Winger. He said the film sagged slightly whenever I was off screen. My mother was over the moon. Movie stardom in abundance, Alec wrote. Years later, I saw him in a bar at a restaurant in D.C. and thanked him for his words, which had given me hope. He smiled and said, "You're welcome. Well, I guess you owe your career to me." I replied, "Don't celebrate quite yet." I haven't seen him since. I auditioned for a role in Amazon High to play a cheerleader, sent back to Amazonian times to teach women how to tame horses and rule the cannibals. It was a ridiculous premise, but I wanted it. I went to the producer's offices at Universal and did the splits, then a cartwheel, then a flip, along with scripted cheers. My body could still do these things easily, without training. I was still a kid, really. The next day, I got the part. I spent the next 7 weeks in New Zealand for the shoot, most of which found me disoriented and melancholy. With all the time alone in a room, while it rained outside during pre-production. I'd been sober since Fox Center. But I went to the land of the long white cloud and became out of sorts and homesick. I walked to the only liquor store I could find and bought the most expensive port I could afford. I gave myself a limit, only one tiny sip a day. I would drink like a normal person, I told myself. But then one night we all went out, and that one night was my undoing. I drank until I blacked out. When I returned to Los Angeles, I was drinking again. I took on some bit roles here and there, but nothing was real. I was tired. I was always tired. I was in my mid-20s and figured I would need to start fibbing about my age, telling directors I was 18 or 20. I felt ancient. Then I heard about a movie called Cruel Inventions, a contemporary riff on the French novel Dangerous Liaisons, set in private school New York. I was going to get the part, I decided. And if I didn't, I would consider giving up. There's no other way to say this. The audition for the upcoming teen drama Cruel Inventions, the title was ultimately changed to Cruel Intentions in post-production, was a big fucking deal in young Hollywood. Everyone was talking about it, buzzing about it, speculating about it. The established young stars, Sarah Michelle Gellar and Ryan Phillippe, had already been cast as the leads. Ryan's girlfriend, Reese Witherspoon, already a high-profile actress, was pending in the role of the ingenue. He would persuade her to take it. The casting director, Mary Verneau, had a small but busy office in Brentwood. I didn't actually yet believe I had any chance of getting the job, so when I went in to see Mary for the part of Cecile Caldwell, I was completely relaxed, not at all invested in the outcome. I had already been crushed losing the Joey Potter role in Dawson's Creek, so I chilled out. Like every young person in Hollywood, I wanted the role of Cecile. I had read the script, and while not the Deer Hunter, I found the whole thing compelling. At the same time, I felt somewhat drained by the constant rejection, maybe even ready to pack it in. I looked forward to getting back to photography or writing, or even a job in a shop. When I strolled into the room, nonchalant, my hands in my pockets, the director, Roger Cumble, immediately asked, "So, how old are you?" I was done lying about my age. After fielding this question at so many auditions, I'd had it. I stiffened and spat back brattily, "How old are you?" At that, he sat up and listened. I could see I'd piqued his interest. He was paying attention. I played it up. I told him I'd just gone across the border to Canada with some friends to buy alcohol, hoping he'd buy that I was under 21 without my actually lying. And then I did the audition using the same energy he brought out in me. I wasn't angry. I wasn't combative. I think I was just a little fed up that day. After doing 7 auditions that week without being noticed, I felt I had nothing to lose. A little mean baby came out of me. But she saved the day because she made him listen. I suppose Roger realized this was the saving grace for the character of Cecile. She didn't have to be the sad victim. His words. She could work humorously. She could be relentlessly irritating. There's a certain power in annoying the shit out of the people who are scheming to take you down. Clueless confidence saved her from a pathetic existence. In the end, it's often the confident people who are the most successful. And Cecile would be a great success. A few days later, Roger and I met at a bar to talk about the part and how to get everyone on board. He talked to Ryan, he talked to Sarah. He really went to bat for me. The cast represented young Hollywood. I was so starstruck and happy I could plots. I was already acquainted with Sarah Michelle Gellar before we met in person. From a voiceover I'd done on Scream 2. Of course, I also knew her from her work. She was the epitome of a young TV star. She had been Kendall on All My Children. From day one, she was a friend to me, both in getting the part and in showing me the ropes. In a lot of ways, our real-life relationship mirrored our dynamic in the film, albeit without all the scheming. She is still one of my closest friends in the world. A mighty nurturer and talent is she. At the table reads, when we first all got together to read the script, I sat next to Reese. She was the most delicate yellow flower. I was completely overwhelmed by the sight. She wore a pale blue cashmere hoodie, Essie ballet slippers on her nails, her blonde hair thick and straight. She was lovely. It was clear to me she was going to be a superstar. Everything about her was impeccable and still is today. Her nails, her cuticles, her brain. She smelled freshly showered and kept her notebook tidy. Her cashmere didn't pill. She never complained. Reese also had the prettiest feet. Even unpedicured, her feet are perfect. My mom loved Reese and her delicate ankles. "You look like you're a different species," she would say. "Oh, don't you feel like a water buffalo when you stand next to her?" I did, actually. I always felt like the awkward outsider around Reese and Ryan. Ryan called her doll when we all went out to dinner, like Frank Sinatra and Ava Gardner. Just like Cecile herself, I was the goofy brown mushroom among the Upper East Side elite. There was only one instance where I felt remotely cool. The cast had moved to New York for the shoot. And one night, we all went out to the Godzilla premiere. It was a huge movie, and everyone who was anyone at that time was there. Prada lent me a dress, and the entire cast went together. I looked up to Reese and felt as if I couldn't let my guard down. I longed to impress her. At one point, Ryan came up and said, "We want to meet Puff Daddy. Do you know how we can meet him?" I saw an in. "Yes, I know him." I didn't really, but we shared a manager. In dopey Cecile fashion, confidence in hand with cluelessness, I rushed up to Puff Daddy. Reese and Ryan instepped behind me and embraced him with a gigantic hug. The audacity. I didn't know you don't just walk up to the biggest star of the moment and introduce him to the stars of your own little movie. The final image of Reese driving off in that 1956 Jaguar Roadster, while the notes of Bittersweet Symphony rise along with the camera, is still one of the most iconic memories from that film. But I think the kiss between Catherine and Cecile, me, is a close second. That kiss, that wet kiss, I'm reminded of it at almost every meeting with a group of younger people. As in, "Hey, you're that girl who kissed Sarah. Do you remember that?" Now perhaps they think I'm so old I wouldn't remember. I wasn't that nervous about kissing Sarah, but I was eager for the scene to be over and done with because we both knew it was going to be somewhat sensational, and there was pressure on us to pull it off. We wanted to get it right, certainly. I remember Sarah's lips were so soft. I wasn't attracted to girls, but I did enjoy the soft, whisker-free lips of SMG on mine. We kissed over and over. During one take, she pulled back, and there was this long trail of spit between us. I thought, surely that won't be the one they use. Of course, the spit take won the day. It reminded me of the sexy scene of Marilyn Monroe's spit string in Niagara. When my mother saw the film, she was appalled that I was such a graphic, sloppy kisser. "Honestly, Selma, did you have to use so much tongue? Your tongue, it's massive, like a creature from Star Wars or something. When are you going to come home and get a real job?" Despite her feigned shock, I knew she must be relieved that I at least managed to get one real Hollywood job. It felt grand. I hoped all movies would be this way, that everything in the world would feel like this. Magazines, newspapers, my first Tonight Show appearance wearing Dolce & Gabbana. I kept the nameplate on my door. It was all easy and fun. After Cruel Intentions, I was offered the role of Vivian Kensington in Legally Blonde because Chloe Sevigny, who had just struck big with the movie Kids, passed on it. At the time, I was the next logical choice, which made me feel that I was in very good company. I did have to audition for Robert Luketic, a few lines. It didn't seem there was a lot to the role. Fine by me, Reese. Yes, please. In the original script by Karen McCullough, Vivian ended up blonde, bubbly, friendly, and best friends with Elle Woods. That part didn't play well, though. Elle was the true and only legal blonde. Vivian was to remain brunette and in the background. To watch Reese command the room so aptly on Legally Blonde was clearly movie star magic. She had just given birth to her beautiful daughter, Ava. She was in excellent shape and worked so hard, always the first one there, always the last one to leave. As ever, she never complained. It made an impression. I learned. When I was working on the movie, I told Amanda Brown, who wrote the original novel the screenplay was based on, how much I loved The Wizard of Oz. So as a gift, she gave me my very own pair of ruby slippers. That was the only time I've ever acted the part of a gleeful child. I jumped up and down yelling, "I got the slippers! I got the slippers!" Although nobody was at my house to witness this exuberant display, they were an exact replica, made especially for me to my exact foot measurements. They even had the same felt glued to the soles, a sound deadener, which allowed Judy Garland to silently dance on a soundstage. We use foam these days. It was such a beautiful, thoughtful, personal gesture, the best gift I had ever received. It seemed to make up for any childhood neglect I ever felt I'd had regarding toys. The shoes live on my mantle, sparkling from the fireplace. More than any role I had, more than any movie, getting those slippers was the most thrilling discovery. I enjoyed myself on that set. It was the first time I let my guard down in front of other people. Ever the goofy sidekick, I kept the crew and cast entertained while Reese did one great take after another in pink stilettos. One time, while I was performing my own shtick outside as some of us stood around the craft services table, I started impersonating a Billy Elliot routine and got so amped up that I actually jumped up into the air. I don't know what happened, but my feet went out from under me. I couldn't locate them. Before I could make sense of it, I was parallel to the ground, then landed flat on my face. It was a colossal fall. Even a Teamster ran over to make sure I was okay. Now I simply say, Billy Elliot, to that crowd. And we all start laughing. When entertaining the troops, I go flat out. The offers came in, some better than others. I was on a roll. I played the titular character in a TV show, Zoe Bean, of Zoe, Duncan, Jack, and Jane. Zoe was the cute girl next door. It didn't take off. The label I'd been given was too embedded in who I was. I never figured out how to play the sweet, stable, capable, pretty person. I excelled at characters who might be called smug or ridiculous. Eccentric, weird prudes became my bread and butter. I never had an arsenal of gentle, weightless, girl-next-door glances. Always the mean baby. I played the girl who was misunderstood and set apart. Her default expression was a dry stare, a barb, her power. She is all the women in my life, my mother, my sisters, or a ridiculous child woman making her way, or all these versions combined. My career was on the rise, but I had a hunch I was not going to be a leading lady. I was a supporting player. That was who I knew how to be. It was also the easier label to give. Stars are few, and not like me, I felt. If you take one message away from this book, let it be this. Labels are sticky. Still, I landed the cover of 17 magazine, a dream get for a young actress in those days. I felt so proud. It was June 1999. I showed up with my freshly cut bangs and was given a chartreuse shrug in a lime green plaid maxi skirt. It's a casual shot. I'm seated, holding my knees, smiling, beaming, really. But my eyes looked small. I sent a copy to my mother in Michigan. She called me as soon as the package arrived. Oh, Selma, she said. You look so unimportant. Oh, when are you going to come home and get a real job? Hollywood. In many ways, my time in Hollywood felt to me like an extension of my Cranbrook days, and that I've taken a liking to almost everyone I've met. I was genuinely friendly and old enough to be damn grateful. As a supporting player, I didn't feel competitive. I've met everyone, it seems. I will have some story, some personal anecdote to share about them. While I like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, I'd bet if the game were changed to 2 degrees of Selma Blair, it would have even more wings. By the way, Kira Sedgwick and I got our hair done by the same colorist and talked just last week. See what I mean? I've met so many great people here among the shits. People I like to run into at the grocery store. The truth is, I don't know that I would fit in elsewhere. It's much easier here, in this setting where people need a bit of a label to be understood. I don't know if they talk behind my back. I'm sure there are a few. But for the most part, I love the women in this town. I love them like my sisters. We talk, we text. We share stories and advice and support one another. I could rattle off big names. I won't. But I did spend a recent big holiday at Sharon Stone's house. Gorgeous place. The first working actress friend I made was Amy Hargreaves. She was a commercial actress in New York while I lived there, and we moved out to LA at the same time. We were with the same agency, and we had been cast in the same first show, Matt Waters, back in New York. She was the star. Upon arrival in LA, we went to a showcase and to dinner after at Jones on Formosa. It was dark inside with red booths and poodle paintings over the tables. Decidedly Hollywood. Lo and behold, Matt Dillon strolled in. He saw us by the door, stopped by to say hi, and asked Amy if she was having any luck. Then he left. Amy moved back to New York and kept on as I did out west. Early in my friendship with Reese, she invited me to a Billy Blank's workout class in Woodland Hills. I was so looking forward to spending time with her. Historically, I am never late. I thought I'd given myself enough time, but this was before GPS. I was coming from work at Warner Brothers, and the drive took longer than expected. As it got closer to the start time, I began to panic. I saw a parking spot and decided to grab it. Little did I know that it was still 2 miles away. Wearing a full face of TV makeup, I walked and ran and sprinted. After around a mile and a half, all I could do was sprint. I am not a sprinter. This might very well be the only time I've sprinted a mile in my life. But I did it, fueled by the rage at my own incompetence. I finally made it to the class, but I was late, sweaty, and wiped out. And now I had to slog my way through a Tai Bo class, a totally new concept. I was lost, totally inept. Halfway through, I thought I was going to die. Reese, on the other hand, sailed effortlessly through it. I had no doubt that if the roles were reversed and she'd somehow made the same idiot blunder I did, she could have run those miles and still made it on time, prepared for class. After class, we went out to dinner at Terra Sushi on Ventura and talked and laughed, Reese putting me at ease as she always does. Her world of work was so beyond my own, and I was fascinated. We chatted and caught up. She mentioned she had just worked on Friends, or was about to, and we both marveled at Jennifer Aniston's incredible physique. I have a recurring nightmare that I'm meeting Reese again, but I park too far away, and only my legs can take me to her on time. I start running, but my legs won't keep at it. So I allow myself too much room for error if I'm going to meet her for lunch. Invariably, I dawdle and fuck up. I always wind up late, and she always waits for me and greets me with a hug after texting back, just be safe. In the early days of Mad Men, Bottega Veneta threw a party that January Jones and I both attended. I'd been feeling sick that day, slurring my words. So I took a couple of shots and a nap, but I still felt off before the party. I figured it was because I hadn't eaten and the alcohol amplified everything. Now I see it was the MS. I was so out of it that I fell asleep mid-sentence during hair and makeup, and then threw up. When I arrived at the party, I laid eyes on January, center stage, who looked stunning as ever. January, I called, making my way through the crowd. You're Betty Draper, I exclaimed once I reached her. Betty Draper! Betty Draper! I kept repeating myself, aware of what was happening, but powerless to stop it. January very calmly put her lovely hand on my shoulder and said, You do know I'm not Betty Draper. It was one of those awkward social encounters, confirmation that I shouldn't have let myself out that day. I should have more champagne, I said before backtracking. Wait, no, I shouldn't. She gently took my hand and reassured me. Oh, we should all always have more champagne, she said, smiling, before returning to the party. We were already good acquaintances, and it wasn't exactly as strange as it appeared. But I spent the night disoriented and sick, and then resigned myself to more champagne. People noticed. Another favorite, Amanda Anka, has a few stories like that about me, too. One took place at the kickoff party for The Sweetest Thing. Amanda was a familiar face to me at a party. Always amiable and inclusive, but I didn't know her well. Have you seen Jason Bateman? I asked her, gesturing across the room. He is so hot. I love him. He's going to be my husband. That's so amazing, Amanda said. He's my fiancé. She was genuinely pleased and amused I made such a gaffe. That is an easygoing betrothed girl. My closest friend is Claire Danes, whom I met at a Sunday night dinner party with my boyfriend, Jason Schwartzman. I remember thinking her skin was so clear. I watched her from across the table, her blonde hair falling over her face, as she leaned forward and pushed her hair behind her ears to listen to the conversation. I'd never seen her in person before, and I told her on that first meeting, right as we were leaving, that I had bacne. And she, very non-judgmentally, told me I should try Proactive. No one was using it. No one had even heard of it back then. She was totally unfazed and offered advice. So I thought, well, there's a practical friend. I decided never to let her go. She remains sacred to me. In a crowded room, I also tend to keep an eye out for Kirsten Dunst, a longtime favorite actress as well. I have always been a bona fide fan. You see, I came to Hollywood late in the game. I'd already gone through college and spent a few years in New York, and by the time I arrived, I didn't feel like a young starlet. It felt strange that one minute I could have been in college in the Midwest, then suddenly find myself across from that actress from Interview with the Vampire, a movie that meant so much to me in my previous life. I always appreciated that. In 2002, I saw Kirsten at a show for Jason's band Phantom Planet at The Standard in LA. We arranged to meet for breakfast the next day. As we walked back to my house, I spotted a paparazzo with a long lens. "What do you do about those paparazzi?" I asked her, assuming such a major young star must have to confront them all the time. It had been a problem for me for years, though I was always photographed by default, by virtue of my neighborhood or the more famous people in the frame. Even so, it always left me feeling ambushed and worried. "Oh, they never photographed me," she answered. "What do you mean?" "There's one right there." I pointed at the photographer crouching in the bushes. In that moment, I witnessed loss of innocence. She was genuinely surprised and befuddled. And in the ensuing years, the paparazzi presence would only grow with the quick multiplication of invaders. I didn't realize how bad their monitoring of young female celebrities would become, nor what an issue it would pose for so many people. Jake Gyllenhaal and I had become friends from Highway, a film we shot in Seattle, in which I'd played a hooker on the run, her only shoes a sparkly red pair, like Dorothy's. When he was shooting Donnie Darko, I stopped by his trailer to visit him. In recent days, he'd seen so many of his school friends having these big successes. "I wonder when it'll be my time," he said. "It is your time," I said. History soon proved me right. When all the pieces line up, Hollywood is captivating. I got to live through another golden age of Hollywood. I have been a witness to the new greats making their mark. Claire invited me to her Hollywood Walk of Fame induction years later, which I attended while my child napped at home. I have a manager. He was my publicist in those early days. We are a team now. Our first meeting was arranged by David Weber, who was my boyfriend and lawyer at the time. My first impression of Troy was that he was trim and handsome, in a black shirt, black pants, and good shoes. The three of us sat in a big conference room overlooking Wilshire Boulevard. And at one point, he leaned over to David and said something like, "Just tell this one she's pretty." I was miffed. It felt condescending, dismissive, invalidating of any talent or intelligence. I didn't say much. "Yeah, he was adorable, but I'm not sure he got me," I recapped with David at the elevator as we were leaving. I may have misunderstood Troy's remark. In any event, I was wrong. He got me. Over the years, I'd had agents and managers I liked and admired, but I struggled to find a true focus or ambition. Troy saw me light up in the hands of a great artist. He knew this world, and he saw something in me. We've been inseparable ever since. We are, in many ways, of brother and sister makeup. We play and annoy. We egg each other on. We call each other monkey. We agree it reads a bit pathetic to have my main gay and cohort a commissioned employee. We are Elizabeth Taylor and Jason Winters, we joke. So fundamental to my life is he. Troy is better than anyone at pushing what he believes in. For years, I thought he was the boss. For years, he thought I was. It was only this past year that we realized we are partners. An epiphany that made us cry. I have never had anyone stand by my side like this man. Troy told me I was America's last great beauty. Although he doesn't remember saying this. Or I misunderstood the remark, again. He had me meet Krista Smith at Vanity Fair. Another person with an incredible eye as well as a brain. The two became like parents to me, even if peers in age. Over the years, I appeared on the cover of Vanity Fair 2 times for the Young Hollywood issue. For the first time, after a long day of Zoe, I flew to Miami for the cover shoot and got a horrible bloody nose on the plane. It wouldn't stop, so I called Troy for help. I was up all night, got my nose quickly cauterized, and showed up on set an hour later, still wiping blood from a spot under my chin, dazed by the greatness of Annie Leibovitz. I was so looking forward to having my hair and makeup done for this shoot, to be made glamorous for Vanity Fair. I had studied the Hollywood covers and knew there was no skimp on gowns or glam. When I entered the room where Annie was setting up for the garden shot, she took one look at me and said, "Don't touch her." At the time, I was shocked. But now I see. She saw me. She saw me exactly as I arrived and thought I was the cool girl for that moment. "Don't do anything," she said. They wiped my face, added a dab of concealer, a swipe of mascara, and that was it. It got better. "This is what you're wearing," she said, and handed me a polka dot leather bikini, still on a hanger. A voice trilled, excited. "Oh my gosh, you finally got someone to wear the bikini!" Already feeling a little long in the tooth, there I was, barefoot, in a leather bikini, void of major hair and makeup, and sitting next to my crush, Wes Bentley, and new friends, Jordana Brewster and Paul Walker. When they turned the fan on, my self-consciousness blew away, and I enjoyed the scene. At one point, Annie was studying me, scrutinizing. She squinted. She whispered something to Sally Hershberger, who threw up her hands and comb. "What can I do if she has a bad haircut and a bald spot?" I think Sally dabbed a little eyeshadow in the widest spot of my part. Troy and I still laugh at this comment, a familiar one by now. From that point on, my bald spots became a short-lived obsession. For a while after that, I carried around a Bobbi Brown eyeshadow to touch up my scalp before auditions. The second time, Annie shot me again, this time for the Young Women in Hollywood issue. Older and wiser, I came armed with a haircut by Chris McMillan. I thought for sure I would be put in a gown, lengthened and made stunning. I waltzed on set in a black turtleneck and a pair of jeans, lean and fresh-faced. Annie glanced up, hugged me briefly, and called out, "Oh, Selma, perfect, nobody touch her." That was my blessing and my curse. With some photographers, they saw me, and there was an instant connection. Tired, dark circles, jeans, whatever. That's Selma. She is who she is. My look didn't translate into the greatness I needed for Hollywood. It didn't align with what it takes to be a leading woman. But it still led me to this incredible life. Troy stayed away on those days to let me be, to honor the reputation of these masters. And when he popped in, freshly buzzed hair, new Prada pants, we always laughed and made others laugh too, possibly at us. But we all had an all right time. My greediest, happiest moments were spent in front of a camera. The glory of my life was that I became the first actress ever to grace the cover of Italian Vogue. In those days, Italian Vogue was everything in fashion. When I got the cover, that was my Oscar. I was Edie Sedgwick in Warhol's house. Steven Meisel waited with his huge brown eyes, long eyelashes, the bandana over his head, and in those days, a cigarette. He processed the pictures in a little tent I couldn't see, and then he emerged to show me. There. That is the lighting test. He laid them out right there in a spread. I looked like the cover. If only I could have Steven Meisel's eye and light frame me forever. That superseded everything. I didn't celebrate this moment. I couldn't fully contemplate it. I was so grateful for it, I didn't know how to put it into words. That was my glory, my dream, alongside my mother's. Looking down the lens at Michael Thompson or Peter Lindbergh or Steven or Annie and having them see me and approve, that's the stuff. Lindbergh and I sent postcards after he shot me, just once, for the Pirelli calendar on the Sony lot. He was charmingly old-fashioned and old-school in the way he created a whole environment with the cold and the fog. Because I am not tall, I am often given underwear to wear, since it does not require alterations. On this Pirelli shoot, I was in underwear and heels, and I was chilly in the manufactured rain and fog, so wardrobe gave me a tuxedo jacket to wear, and I walked toward Peter. "I love this energy," he called. That became the shot. The makeup artist Gucci Westman gave me a red lip, which I loved. She was the first to pull that off on me. I couldn't wait for my mother to approve. I was finally playing the part she wanted me to. I'm not sure she ever even saw it. My mother always wanted a full report. What were the compliments, Selma? Like when Michael Thompson confided to Josie that I moved better than most models, up there with Kate Moss. I didn't allow the sublime glee I felt to get out. Not to anyone, not even to Troy. I was afraid. Afraid I would attract attention. Afraid Elliot would somehow ruin it, or me. So I became private about my successes. And then there were the duds. As soon as a photographer says, "Relax," I know it's all over. All he sees is a short Jewish girl from the Midwest whom he needs to make into a star. Relax makes me feel inadequate and stiff. I never knew how to behave in those moments when I knew someone couldn't see me. Inwardly, I would disappear. These days, I see myself everywhere, quite literally. As I write this, I am surrounded by large framed portraits of yours truly, that hang all over my house, relics of those indelible gifts. I'm a Saturday Night Live sketch of a Hollywood actress, a house wearing its owner on its sleeve. Then there were the powerful, magnificent cheerleaders, the prophets of some great promise I am still waiting to fulfill, the writer, editor, and cultural figure, Ingrid Cishi, was that person for me. From our first meeting at a Vanity Fair dinner, she saw a glimmer of something in me. She saw me in all my awkwardness and believed in me fully. Ingrid was born in South Africa and became a fixture in the New York media scene as the editor-in-chief of Art Forum and later Interview. She invested in it all, art, celebrity, culture, music, and fashion especially. With her big warm questions and welcoming face, she was a tastemaker who set people in motion. She was so encouraging of others, of people with talent. Miraculously, she became my mentor. She would tell me about the people I should know, really know, Miuccia Prada and Karl Lagerfeld, and I would tell her whom she should, Amy Adams and Kate Bosworth and Scarlett Johansson. One day, long before Kanye West was famous, Ingrid and I were sitting in an upstairs Japanese restaurant, sharing one of our first lunches. "Kanye, you gotta know him," she said. "He has an album coming out soon, and he is brilliant, brilliant." She connected me to everyone and everything that was fabulous, and she did it single-handedly because her influence was that big. She created this energy around artists and interactions. And for some reason, she really saw me as a star or a fellow changemaker. Soon after we met, I became guest West Coast editor of Interview. Because Ingrid's two closest friends in fashion were Carl and Mucha, she made sure I was part of something. Emuse. I was doing campaigns for Prada and Miu Miu and Chanel. Ingrid did know I was prone to severe depression. And she gave me places to go, things to do. She gave me work and assignments and a direction. She kept me afloat. I lived a dream in the fashion world largely thanks to Ingrid, under Troy's approval. She was an incredible woman to have in your corner. When she died of cancer on July 24th, 2015, at the age of 63, the media world was shaken. I was shocked. From Graydon Carter's obituary, Ingrid was a great friend, and therefore she had a lot of friends. And they will be utterly bereft for the next little while, so be kind to them. They will be the ones wandering the streets or just staring off into the middle distances, lost in the knowledge that a beloved original in an age of generics has gone somewhere else and left them behind. Now I really see how much she did for me, and I wish I'd known how to run with it then, but I was quiet. God, how I wish Ingrid were here. I would do anything now. Anything she asked, without hesitation. For so much time, I was breathless with appreciation, and I didn't even know how to address it. One day, I thought, I'll be able to tell her. I figured that eventually she would teach me enough so I could finally find the right actions to say thank you, to make her proud to have found me and believed in me. It was through Ingrid that I found my way to Carl. He actually came to my house on Cynthia Street to shoot me for Interview Magazine. Ingrid came in from New York, as well as Loren Scott, who was the stylist that day. Before Carl arrived, Loren and I decided it would be fun to dress me up as him. This was right when he'd lost the weight and was in the sexy, libertine, rocker chic look with the cravat and the tight jeans. His were so tight, so pegged, with the balls to the right, I made a comment about the crotch area. Ugh, again, the audacity of me. When he saw me dressed as Carl, he gave a smile. We embraced. I wanted to do more. More theatrics, more drama. But instead, he had me take it all off, keeping only my own tank top on. Just a touch of mascara and gel in my spiky hair. It was swelteringly hot that day. I spent most of it trying to look serene in the skylight of my very small house. Carl looked around, aiming for the best light. He pointed to the skylight and asked if I would get up there. Go right up to the light. I climbed on the shoulders of his muscular companion, a gorgeous young man, naturally. I balanced there, like a young girl playing chicken fight in a pool, looking down at Carl. Good, good, this is you, he said, and we were done. On our lunch break, Carl's only request was a Diet Coke. I didn't have a Diet Coke in the house, and that was his only request. Forevermore, I keep a Diet Coke on hand, in honor of him. For years afterward, Ingrid raved about the lunch I provided that day, which was and still is hilarious to me because I'm pretty sure she provided it. I am many things, but I am no hostess. From that very first meeting, I loved Carl and felt at home with him. Carl and I became friends, actually. He was obviously the most brilliant man I have ever met. He was spotless. He even smelled clean. His hands were like a mechanic's. Handsome worker hands. Not rough, just big and capable. He was incredible. He was the revered one. Everything about him was otherworldly. His shape, his presence, his style. I don't think there will ever be another figure in fashion so suited for greatness. Carl always sent pink peonies when we shopped together, a sumptuous bounty of pale, full blooms. Heavenly. I remember opening the door to my hotel room in Paris and discovering the entire space was infused with the scent of these arrangements. Oh, to have a small, perfect room on the left bank, filled with peonies sent by Carl. I mourned having to leave them so soon, still fresh. I hope someone at the Hotel Montalembert saved them after I'd gone. Sometimes I look back, and I still don't know how I got there. I don't know how Carl shot me and loved me and put me up in a hotel filled with such glorious petals that my hair and clothes still held the scent even after I got home. Throughout my years of being a still life, I have only one regret. I wish I had picked up my own camera more often. I regret not having stood on the other side of the lens. I was exposed to so many phenomenal artists, but I never shot them. I worried I'd be seen as an intruder, an outsider. At the Vanity Fair shoot in Miami, I had gathered that Penelope Cruz brought a camera everywhere she went. She'd just bring the camera to her beautiful face and, click, took photos of everyone else. She had such a lovely European way about her. It never looked invasive. I felt like a clunky American girl, so I rarely brought my own lens. Now I wish I had. Regrets. I have a few. On Cynthia Street, Carl posed with me before leaving. It was the one time I dared to pick up my little vintage Ecru camera. "Let's have a shot," I ventured. He accepted. "Yes." "Here is good?" he asked. We stood on the edge of a fountain, the sunlight slicing our heads. The snap is framed on my desk, unflattering to both of us in the harsh glare, but the only shot I have. I lived well in those years. Paris and shows, diamonds and gowns with provenance, dresses from the archives. In the moments when I dared to consider it, it felt wonderful. I've had an enchanted life. I still consider myself one of the luckiest girls in Hollywood. The Man and the Muse. During a lighting setup on Cruel Intentions, I went searching for Reese. I found her next to Ryan, talking to a handsome man I didn't know. He had height and bore a resemblance to JFK Jr. He looked good, and I'd learn he looked even better on paper. Roger, the director, brought me over and said, "This is Ryan's lawyer, David Weber. He'll probably try to sign you. Don't do it." I shook his hand and said it was nice to meet him. He looked bored. "Well, then," I thought, "I'll be off." I left him with the two cherubs and went on to craft services. I was surprised when, after our meet-cute, which was not very cute, he asked me out. After running into each other at a function where he gave me a wave hello, barely an acknowledgement, he called and asked if I would like to go to Roger's birthday dinner with him. "I will come get you," he said, and I said, "Sure." He picked me up in his long silver Volvo station wagon, which felt very lawyerly. I was still living at my first apartment then and felt intimidated by his professional air. Over the course of the next few weeks, David came to really like me, and I came to like him too. David was solid, adult, steady, and gorgeous. We fell in love. The adults in my life celebrated our relationship. I felt, based on some vague societal standard, that I was supposed to be moving forward, toward something, in a direction. I was an adult, and adults were meant to find a person to commit to. David represented exactly what I thought that was. Our relationship progressed, and he bought us a Spanish 1920s house. It was idyllic, right down to our neighbors, Reese and Ryan, who lived in a charming bungalow up the street. Across the street from them was Winona's house, with big, incredible yellow trumpet-flowering trees that smelled heavenly, like jasmine, but are in fact very toxic. Crazy-making, if brewed or eaten. David planned to propose to me one ill-fated weekend at a Cranbrook-Kingswood reunion in 2000. I was afraid he was going to ask. When we arrived in Michigan, I became very ill with a fever and headache. He had told my mom his plan and had even bought the ring. But once he saw how sick I was, he put a pin in it. He did eventually ask me, the morning after a Cosmo Girl photo shoot. He presented me with an elegant, emerald-cut diamond. Bravo, David Weber. It was so flawlessly beautiful that I tried to hide it when out, worried what people would think of someone so young and inexperienced with such a perfect ring. So I was engaged, but it was not so simple. David was my ideal, but I was about to meet my muse. The first time I saw Jason Schwartzman on screen in Wes Anderson's charming Rushmore, David in the theater seat beside me, he took my breath away. I'd never seen anyone like him. Not Dustin Hoffman, not Tom Cruise. He was charming and captivating and pure. The prep school where Rushmore took place reminded me so much of Cranbrook, and Jason's character's love for his school reminded me of my own commitment to my school. He had such charisma. I was enamored. When the movie was over, I turned to David and said, "Wow, he was great." And he said, "You know, that's Talia Shire's son." I kept returning to Jason in my thoughts. When Cruel Intentions premiered, I went on Total Request Live on MTV, where I was asked, "Do you have a celebrity crush?" And I answered, "Jason Schwartzman from Rushmore." As if I could will him to me. I had no bones about making my infatuation with him public, because in no universe did I ever imagine that we would wind up together. Months later, at a photo shoot, I learned that the photographer shooting me knew Jason. So I persuaded Jazzy to get Jason to come to the shoot as a special request. "I'll stay longer if you can get him to come," I begged. Then there he was. His eyes were unreal in person. The color of a passionate storm sky. I was smitten. I was in a black tuxedo and skirt. He handed me a daisy he'd picked from the grass and gently kissed me on the lips. The moment was captured in a tiny contact sheet frame that I still have on my shelf. He was a boy. Only 19. I was 25 or so. I thought of him as a child, and myself as a much older woman. I was madly in love from the moment I met him. It felt like a homecoming of spirit, as if I'd known him forever, destined, a simultaneous heartbreak and joy. Much later, he came to my house, the home I shared with David, who was at his office in Beverly Hills. Jason looked around, taking in all the trappings of adulthood. "You really are a grown-up," he said. When we got to the part where I showed him the view in the balcony, he sat on the edge of the tub, looked around, and said, "Wow, this is a lot." We already knew we loved each other. I looked at him, knowing full well that we would have some future together. "If we fall in love, this will end badly," I whispered. I was immediately angry at myself. It sounded just like something my mother would say, sabotaging it before anything had even taken hold. Jason looked at me and rested his chin on the heel of my hand. And that was that. In many ways, a relationship with Jason felt like an impossibility. I was living with another man. I loved David very much, but I felt too big a pull toward Jason. I was immediately in love with him in that emotional, overpowering, strange teenage way. I knew it wasn't possible to move forward with both of them. My heart chose Jason. My breakup with David was murky and sad. I remember listening to Play, the Moby album, on repeat as I packed up the home we'd shared. Sadly, I gave back the perfect ring when I called off the engagement. Though we never did tie the knot, I remained married to David, in a way, for decades, because he continued to be my lawyer. A few months later, Jason